Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we, and I say we because we've got Paul here with us. Welcome back, Paul.
Hey, G.R. Thank you.
Oh, no, thank you. I wish we could have had you all week. I just, my schedule was just too tight this week. But anyway, we're only 4 pages into a 14-page document. And already Madison has, you know, really methodically taken us through how clearly the resolutions and the intent or what has to happen is interposition where the states unite and force the federal government into compliance. And he's clearly stating, and has really clearly stated already, that there is no other course of action, that nullification is well, he doesn't say this, but I will say this, that it is just as bad as an Article 5 convention.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, because see, an Article 5 convention, they're trying to do something good. They're trying to, you know, create an amendment that, you know, either helps the states do something, helps the federal governments do something, you know, make some kind of change. But when the real problem is enforcement to the compact,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, nullification only exacerbates the problem because when you start having states, you know, haphazardly saying, well, we don't like this law, we don't like this law, and they just start creating their own, you know, resistance without unifying. All that does is create chaos, and it allows us to become divided. And a divided union is not good. Not
right.
good at all.
You know, the Missouri flag has bold words imprinted on it. United we stand, divided we fall. And like he says, if states were all each to go in their own different direction, we truly would be divided. And Madison's got the answer here.
Yes, he does. And so we're kind of looking at how, I guess what I need to do is I need to really spell out how emphatic. Now, Madison has been, I think, probably one of the best that has been succinct and concise and to the point. He doesn't beat around the bush. You just don't do this. But apparently he really feels, I mean, I think this is probably one of his most emotionally charged documents I've ever read.
When was it he wrote this?
In 1834, about 5 years before he passed.
Okay.
And so he really took the, you know, the time to write out these details. So he's almost thoroughly gone through the report because as I see ahead, he talks about, you know, the tribunals and that type of stuff. He's going to start talking about that, which is towards the end of his report. The beginning talks about the resolutions and clearly how that's the only thing that can happen. So anyway, without any further ado, he's actually going to be quoting out of his report up here. So go ahead, because this is right here. This is out of paragraph 18 of his report, of the Madison's, James Madison's report on the Virginia Resolutions of 1800, which we've already read. But he's going to cite this. So right here, go ahead.
Okay, so we're in paragraph 29, right?
29, correct.
Okay, here we go. Thus the report observes, quote, "The states then being the parties to the Constitutional Compact and in their highest sovereign capacity, it follows of necessity that there can be no tribunal above their authority to decide in the last resort whether the compact made by them be violated, and consequently, that is, the parties to it, they must themselves decide in the last resort, such questions as may be of sufficient magnitude to require their interposition, end quote.
Okay, so clearly he's pointing out that only the states have the authority to decide, one, whether the Constitution's being violated, and two, what they need to do, the magnitude of their interposition. I mean, do they need to clean house and get rid of people? Do they need to, see, folks, this is why I tell you that even though people will say that a revolution is an option on the table, you hear people say the ballot box, the soap box.
The jury box, the soap box, and the ammo box.
And there you go, the ammo box. And the ammo box implies revolution. I will tell you that the one guaranteed path of losing the Constitution is a revolution. There's never been a revolution that has ever ended up where they preserve their liberty and they preserve their government the way it was designed. What always happens is, look at France. I mean, look at every revolution that's ever happened. So our revolution was one of those unique ones. But I'm telling you, we have a great government. We don't have a despotic government. So in other words, the cause of this revolution would be to undermine our government completely. And we would not have a constitution coming out of the other side. And I'm just telling you, we're far better off struggling and learning for ourselves as we crawl out of this ditch. Because as we learn and as we go through interposition, and as we start dealing with the lumps and, the suffering, the slings and arrows of austerity, we will at least have a mechanism of correcting any types of problems that the union would need to get the rest of the, to get all of the states fully recovered. So let's go ahead and go with paragraph 30.
Okay. Now, apart from the palpable insufficiency of an interposition by a single state to effect the declared object of the interposition, namely to maintain authorities and rights which must be the same in all states, it is not true that there would be no tribunal above the authority of a state as a single party, the aggregate authority of the parties being a tribunal above it to decide in the last resort.
Right. So each state, what he's saying here is each state does have this sovereignty to choose for themselves what to do. But he's saying that they do not have the level of power to force the interposition upon the federal government. The federal government knows this. The federal government basically understands that it takes a majority of us, and they are just laughing at us because we can't get organized to do it. And so what he basically says is, but the authority above that is the unified parties. In other words, when the states unify and collectively bring their power together, the more states that are unified on full compliance of the Constitution, the greater that power becomes. If we have all 50 states, it is insurmountable. If we have a majority of states, it is sufficient. It requires a majority.
Actually, does it even require, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Does it even require a majority? Because if you have a third of the states,
So what you have is you have one third of the states that can inflict control and pain on Congress. You have to have a majority of the states to inflict a majority of pain upon Congress. So what is a majority in the Senate? It's 26 states.
Right.
You can easily inflict and force those 52 senators to comply.
Okay.
But when it comes to Congress, or the House of Representatives, I should say, you have to have a majority. You know, what is, I think it's what, 200 and what, 15, 13, something like that.
Something like
that. And I think it's where
maybe
we...
Maybe 217.
Where we find the sweet spot right now, I think, is 27 states. But I mean, so you have to look at the representation. And, oh, by the way, I haven't recalculated, because as of 2020, the representation of states, because California lost some, and many of the red states gained.
Mm.
And that's because, you know, there are so many people that have fleed out of California.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of these refugees from California landing in all of these different red states going, give me sanctuary. So anyway, as the invaders, as they open their arms to the invaders to give them sanctuary.
Right.
California has been a treasonous state, and their Democratic governors have been committing treason. As a matter of fact, every single one of them should be up on charges. You know, Newsom, Brown, all of these governors, and maybe even Arnie.
Mm-hmm.
Did Arnie do enough? Davis. I mean, we need to go all the way back to where we finally find a governor that was standing up saying, we cannot allow invaders into our country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just on one issue, folks. That's not on all the other issues that the Constitution demands. We could go all the way back to the 60s, where the California started violating the Commerce Clause.
Right.
Where they stopped allowing Detroit and other car manufacturers that were, you know, building cars somewhere else in the United States, allowing them to sell in their state unless they met EPA standards. It's the same thing with Washington State. Any of these states that are violating the Commerce Clause, because we're not going to allow you to ship coal through our state or out our ports. When they do that, they're committing treason. So,
yeah.
Anyway, we're now, I guess, at 31. So, to be clear, though, he is painstakingly, and we're only on the fourth going into the fifth page, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let me see.
Right.
Here. Yep. We're coming into the fifth page now. So, he's painstakingly going through both the resolutions and his report. But he's not. This is one of the most thorough documents he ever has made in grinding on a topic. That's what I really wanted to point out. This is not a short, concise, and succinct, you know, they only have these powers, and you know, anything beyond those enumerated powers is unconstitutional. I mean, he's always been very to the point. And in this, he's getting to the point, but he's grinding through the details. Go ahead, 31.
Okay. And again, the language of the report is, quote, if the deliberate exercise of dangerous powers palpably withheld by the Constitution could not justify the parties to it in interposing insofar as to arrest the progress of the evil and thereby preserve the Constitution itself as well as to provide for the safety of the parties to it, there would be an end to all relief from usurped power, end quote. Apply here the interposition power to a single state, and it would not be true that there would be no relief from usurped power. A sure and adequate relief would exist in the interposition of the states as the co-parties to the Constitution with a power paramount to the Constitution itself.
Now, that's the father of the Constitution stating that these states, when they collectively come together to interpose with power paramount to the Constitution itself, in other words, the power they possess is greater than the power they've imposed or have delegated to that federal government.
Hmm. 32.
Go ahead.
But, quote, but, continues the report.
Okay, so this is right here where he goes into the judiciary and attacks the concept that the judiciary is the final repository or arbiter. Go ahead.
Great. But, continues the report, it is objected that the judicial authority is to be regarded as the sole expositor of the Constitution in the last resort, end quote. In answering this objection, the report observes that, quote, however true it may be that the judicial department is in all questions submitted to it by the forms of the Constitution to decide in the last resort, this resort must necessarily not be the last in relation to the rights of the parties to the Constitution, constitutional compact, from which the judicial as well as the other departments hold their delegated trusts. On any other hypothesis, the delegation of judicial power would annul the authority delegating it, and the concurrence of this department with the others in usurped power might subvert forever and beyond the possible reach of any rightful remedy the very Constitution which all were instituted to preserve.
Right. And now I've kind of enlarged the font a little bit because it almost seems like he's yelling here. Go ahead.
Okay. 33. Here is a direct proof that the authority of the Supreme Court of the U.S. was understood by the legislature of Virginia to have been to an interposition of the states against of the alien and sedition laws.
Okay, so that little bracket there was a reference to, I think, Monroe. And so I just kind of removed that. So there are some, I'll just say, personal edits that I've made because in the brackets, they were something that he was kind of saying to somebody specifically. And so to have been an interposition of the states against all of the Alien and Sedition Acts. Anyway, so here he's yelling. He's basically saying, here's the proof, folks. They don't have the authority. And this is what was understood by the state legislature during the ratification debates. When he says that, when he says was understood, that means, and so when people want to know, does one ratification debate, you know, trump the rest of them? In other words, if something was clarified in one of the ratification debates that wasn't clarified in the others, but it becomes a legal term and definition to that state because of the uniformity clause, because the federal government cannot treat any of the parties differently, it's all applied. This is why I say the only state that actually pointed out that the representatives in the Senate and the House of Representatives in Congress cannot pass a law and immune themselves from that oppression, that means that they cannot create their own retirement. They cannot protect themselves from these same requirements like vaccinations and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
If they have the power to do it and they can inflict it upon we the people like going to war, then they can equally go to war.
Mm.
Right.
Mm.
Right. So that's the whole point. So he was basically kind of pointing out the beautiful thing about contract law, and especially this little clause that ties all of these terms and definitions together via that uniformity clause. Because if it's understood by one, it is understood by all. So moving on, go ahead. What's 34?
Yeah. No, 34.
Right.
We can avoid seeing the necessity of understanding by the, quote, parties, end quote, to the Constitutional Compact, the authority which made the compact and from which all the departments held their delegated trusts. These trusts were certainly not delegated by a single party. By regarding the term parties in its plural, not individual meaning, the answer to the objection is clear and satisfactory. Take the term as meaning a party and not the parties, and there's neither truth nor argument in the answer. But further, on the hypothesis that the rights of the parties meant the rights of a party, it would not be true as affirmed by the report that, quote, the delegation of judicial power would annul the authority delegating it, and that the concurrence of this department with others in usurped power, it might subvert forever and beyond the reach of any rightful remedy the very Constitution which all were instituted to preserve, end quote. He repeats this quote again.
Right. And so this is really important. This is why I've highlighted it, or basically enlarged the font again. You know, because what happens when somebody repeats something? They're really emphasizing. There you go. Right. Go ahead.
So let's finish 34. However deficient a remedial right in a single state might be to preserve the Constitution against usurped power, an ultimate and adequate remedy would always exist in the rights of the parties to the Constitution, in whose hands the Constitution is at all times, but clay in the hands of the potter, and who could apply a remedy by explaining, amending, or remaking it, as the one or the other mode might be the most proper remedy.
Now, what he's saying here is he's saying that once the parties unite, it is their obligation to enforce the compact. If they come to a conclusion that the Constitution is the problem, then the Constitution can be, or they could then move towards a convention of amending. Now, the audit process and this process right here is not a convention. Now you'd actually need to have 2/3 of the states. Now you'd actually need to, because if you're doing all of this with 27 states, you can't just move into a convention, right?
Right.
Okay. So it's not like they're going to be able to remake the Constitution or amend it. But they do have the power to start explaining it and then telling the rest of the states, because what is explaining? And explaining is like looking at the Commerce Clause and saying, we don't think the federal government understands what this regulate commerce among the states really means. And mm-hmm. so we have to further define this, and then you basically do a round robin through the union, and everybody comes up with what they finally hack away at this little clause and say, we agree at what this clause is. And then mm-hmm. they could basically go and say, this is the term and definition that you will apply to that clause. Because they're the parties. They're the ones that came to the agreement of what they were going to do and grant to that federal government. The federal government had no play. They had no say whatsoever as to what was going to be in that Constitution. Oh, can you guys give us, ice cream on Fridays? They didn't have that at all. They had no influence.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is where he basically really uses this metaphor in saying the Constitution is at all times but clay in the hands of the potter when the states come together. Now, when they come together with 27 states, they still have to meet the threshold. They need 7 more states to create that constitutional convention. So they'll need at least more. But to enforce, they only need a majority.
Okay.
And so what will happen is you could actually have a move to replace the Speaker of the House. You can't move and replace the Vice President as the pro tem of the Senate, but you can move to change out the majority control if this doesn't happen during an election time frame. In other words, there's an election and then we kick off Republic Review. If Republic Review happens in a midterm or in the middle of an election session, then mm-hmm. you'll have enough people to say, our leadership is inept and inadequate in leading in what we need to do. And that's why you can actually challenge and have a move to go down this path of, and we're going into a break here, so go down this path of changing out the Speaker of the House and the rest of the leadership, because actually what could be happening, and I'll get into this when we come back, what could be happening is the makeup of Congress could actually be changing in this process. So, and this is the power of an individual state. This is, so we'll get into this as a part of Interposition right after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one of the things that Madison kind of talks about is how the states, only the states have the power to really force the directives of, you know, you have to do this, you have to stop doing that. And each state, though, even though it requires this majority, each state can hold their senators and their representatives in Congress accountable, and they can hold them in violation, you know, of their charge and their obligation under the Constitution, and actually have them deported or extradited and replaced by charging them with treason against the state.
Strong terms.
Yes. It only requires that, you know, any citizen of this state that represents this state in any federal capacity will be held to their oath of office that they must support the Constitution in all things. That's all you really need to add to your state constitution. It's not a part of their oath. It becomes a law of the land for that state and all of its citizens. And then if they actually violate their oath of office by failing to support, you now have a law in the state to extradite them for committing treason against the state and the state laws. It severs this tie between, you know, when it comes to treason against the U.S. Constitution, then who has jurisdiction?
Right.
The federal court has jurisdiction. But when it comes to treason against the state, then that's a state constitutional, and they have jurisdiction over that. You have violated our law. We don't care about if the federal court's not going to have jurisdiction. We, you know, or if they don't feel the same way, we actually have it specified in our Constitution. So we really do need to start creating. And by the time a state gets to this point where they're demanding compliance to the Constitution, these kinds of amendments come quickly. State mm-hmm. legislature could throw it out there. The voters will vote for it. And I'll tell you, most of the voters would vote for it, especially in all of these red states. It would be no problem whatsoever. Texas would be able to get that passed. And look at how many Democrats actually come from Texas, because it has such a large population. And, it's, you know, there are large concentrations of Democrats, but it pales in comparison to the Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
The only reason Texas is becoming bluer and bluer and more corrupt is because of all of the money there and because of the parties.
Right.
Because the parties are instrumental in corrupting your public servants, folks. They don't care about holding them accountable. They care about ensuring that the unified agenda is adhered to. That's all they care about. Anyway, anywho, So now we're on 35. And so as you can kind of see, he's now going to be jumping back and talking about the resolutions. So it's like he's kind of cycling back. And now, okay, well, I've covered this. I've kind of gone through the whole gamut. And then he goes through by using a different view of going through the gamut again. Now, I've never seen Madison in any of his writings. Now, this is kind of a personal, but this is an instructional set of notes and or compiled notes that he sent to Monroe and others. I don't know who was all on the list, but he wanted everybody to know. And I find it interesting that when he was communicating like this, like I was reading, and I haven't read him yet, and forgive me for going down this little rat hole, but Jefferson made a comment that the land belongs in usufruct.
The land belongs in what?
Usufruct.
I've never heard that term.
Yeah, it's an old term, but that it belongs to the living. The land belongs to the living is the basic concept. And so he wrote this letter to Madison, and Madison replied. And I think this is the only dialogue I've ever seen, but this is one of those ideas that kind of stewed in Jefferson's mind. But see, they weren't living in a time like today where, you know, he could see that we were going to head down that path where all of a sudden land would be controlled and restricted because of, you know, permanent property rights with families and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so he goes, well, you know, is that something that would be best? And let's look at it today. Is that what's best? When corporations and citizens can actually buy up land and, you know, keep it forever and use it to how they want to. In other words, I choose not to feed you. In other words, somebody could come into your state if they have enough money and buy up all the agricultural, you know, land and say, I choose not to feed you. I choose to let this land go into, you know, a dust bowl condition so that you will be forced to eat bugs and what I think you need to eat. Now we're looking at somebody who's unelected that is now asserting a level of power like government.
But wouldn't that be trampling on that person's right to do with the land what he wants? Now, bear with me, GR. I've been asked this very question.
Oh, I understand that. So I understand that. So does a person have a right to conduct economic warfare against the citizens of their state? That what your question is?
See, that's not the way it's framed.
No. But that's if you boil down what they're doing. Let's just say, you know, you live in a country and you're all by, you know, you have to either export from another country or you use your own resources and you don't have the ability to make rock and clay houses. The only thing you have is to build forests, you know, and to grow forest and harvest the forest and use this little forest that you have. And if somebody buys up the forest and says, you can't create new houses.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we can't do anything else, they're going to force you to live in holes in the earth. In other words, is that right that somebody can come in and inflict that kind of change upon all of the people of a state, of a nation?
I would say not.
There you go.
And, you know, we are experiencing economic warfare from foreign ownership of land in my state.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the argument I shared is, by extension, if you can sell any land to a foreign entity, by extension, you could conceivably sell all of it. And then where are your freedoms?
Right. So this is where the states really need to, you know, start getting smart and start understanding, you know, some fundamentals to basically say, you know, we have to identify what our strategic interests really are. Our energy is one of those things. If we have, you know, oil in our rock and sands, then fracking is essential to us. Mm-hmm. Or drilling for oil is essential for us. Or, you know, this form of, because in Washington State, Inslee and the progressives, now, so Washington State has been selling. Why are they selling electricity? Because they have an abundance of it.
Abundance of electricity?
Oh, absolutely.
How are they generating this? Is this through water power?
Through hydroelectric, right.
Okay.
They have, I think, one nuclear plant, but they have all of these hydroelectric dams. And so they've been selling, and as Washington State's consumption of the electricity has grown, they've been selling less and less, but for the last five decades, California used to be a very large recipient and consumer of Washington State's electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because it gets out onto the grid, and they're the ones that are buying that. They're the ones that put the power lines in so that they can basically export or, you know, have a line of communication or a line of transmission into California.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at Washington State and the fact that it has this natural resource of dams of creating electricity, now Governor Inslee, just as bad as Newsom, I mean, they've started putting up these stupid, absolutely unproductive windmills all over the mountains out here. It is just mm-hmm. absolutely an eyesore. And as a matter of fact, it just infuriates me to see that they've bought into this. You know, this has nothing to do with what's good for Washington State, because what they're going to do is they're going to create the land of plenty, because we had plenty of energy to where it was. And because energy was so cheap in Washington, a lot of houses actually used electrical heat.
Mm.
It was, right. I mean, electricity was cheaper in Washington a long time ago than it was anywhere else practically because we just had that abundance. We were selling it. We were making money on it. And so Inslee has this proposal and design to actually destroy the dams and remove them.
What?
He has a plan to destroy the dams and remove them. And so that's the plan. They want to actually take away America's ability to actually provide adequate energy. The real plan overall, they just can't say this, but the real plan is they need a lot of us to die. We have way too many people, and we have to depopulate you. And the best way to do that is by starving you, making you freeze through the suffering of winter or through the excessive heats, you know, of the summer. Because those people, you know, that's how old people tend to die.
Mm-hmm.
We have what we would, I would just say it's the cruelest government of all. But anyway, it has never been this cruel, but let's get back into what Madison was going to get. He was literally kind of rehashing through the resolutions again. So go ahead with 35.
We're on 35 now, right?
Uh-huh, 35.
Such being the comment of the report on the third resolution, it fully demonstrates the meaning attached to it by Virginia when passing it and rescues it from the nullifying misconstruction into which the resolution has been distorted.
Keep going.
Let it next be seen how far the comment of the report on the seventh resolution above inserted accords with that on the third, and that this may the more conveniently be scanned by every eye. The comment is subjoined at full length.
Uh-huh, keep going.
37. Here is certainly not a shadow of countenance to the doctrine of nullification under every aspect. It enforces the arguments and authority against such an apocryphal version of the text.
Do you think he's mincing words here?
No.
I mean, so, you know, here he's kind of editorializing and getting back into this. And so keep going through 38 and 39.
Okay, 38. From this view of the subject, those who will duly attend to tenor of the proceedings of Virginia and to the circumstances of the period when they took place will concur in the fairness of disclaiming the inference from the undeniableness of a truth that it could not be the truth meant to be asserted in the resolution. The employment of the truth asserted and the reasons for it are too striking to be denied or misunderstood. 39. More than this, the remark is obvious that those who resolve the nullifying claim into the natural right to resist intolerable oppression are precluded from inferring that to be the right meant by the resolution, since that is as little denied as the paramountship of the authority creating a constitution over an authority derived from it. GR. Oh,
yes, yes, yes.
Okay. As you know, the language of the founders, you know, and what I would say here is Madison is kind of, he's not just being very clear. He's kind of riled up. And these two paragraphs.
Okay, so he uses words that really throw people off.
Yes, they defy today's understanding.
Yeah, because who uses tenor? The tone.
What's that?
When he says, duly attend to the tenor of the proceedings, what he means is the tone, you know, the anxiety, you know, the mood and the mind model of the people of the Virginia and the circumstances of the period when they took place will concur in the fairness. In other words, in the logical, you know, process of disclaiming the inference. In other words, you know, they will have this logical, you know, understanding of how they're disclaiming this undeniable truth, that it could not be the truth meant to be asserted in the resolution, the employment of the truth asserted, and the reasons for it are too striking to be denied or misunderstood. More than this, the remark is obvious that those who resolve the nullifying claim into the natural right to resist intolerable oppression are precluded, in other words, they are inhibited from making that reference that to be the right meant in the resolution. In other words, they can't make this claim because there's no there. That's, you know, we talk like that today, right? And
right.
So what he's saying is they do not have the right, they cannot make any reference whatsoever of what this resolution really means, because nobody can deny, because since that is as little denied, nobody can deny as the paramount or as the utmost importantness of the authority of the states creating a constitution over an authority derived from it.
Okay. 40 is going to be hot.
Yes.
Okay. The true question, therefore, is whether there be a constitutional right in a single state to nullify a law of the U.S. We have seen the absurdity of such a claim in its simple, naked, and suicidal form. He is definitely not mincing words now.
No, he's not. I mean, he calls these guys nullifiers. Like he calls, it's almost like calling them idiots. Go ahead.
Let us turn to it as modified by South Carolina into a right in every state to resist within itself the execution of a federal law deemed by it to be unconstitutional and to demand a convention of the states to decide the question of constitutionality, the annulment of the law to continue in the meantime and to be permanent unless 3/4 of the states concur in overruling the annulment. Now, what is he referring to here? He's referring to something that was done by South Carolina.
Yeah, so if you remember, South Carolina demanded that they could legitimately get away with, if you probably haven't heard, so you may want to go back and listen to day one. But when he starts identifying this doctrine, he points out that South Carolina says that any state has a right to nullify and not follow a law and completely, separate themselves from that law in their state until 34 states in the union say that that's a legitimate law. Like Obamacare, that one state would just say, you can't, we're not going to abide, we're not going to invoke Obamacare until 34 states actually amend the Constitution to say we have to do it. And so that's the whole point here. He's basically saying that they're demanding a constitutional convention to answer this question of the constitutionality of the annulment of the law. See, that's what he says. And if you keep on going, the annulment of the law to continue in the meantime and to be a permanent unless three-fourths of the states concur in overruling their annulment, in the nullifying of the law. So
interesting.
Yeah.
So what they're saying is one state thinks it can nullify this until the other states come aboard.
Either the other states come aboard or the other states, come to a point where they all agree that they're not going to abide by this. One way or the other, right? Either they're going to not abide by it, they'll finally have the power to nullify it, or three-fourths of the states will actually, say, we're making this legitimate law, and now you have to follow it. See, South Carolina basically says, we're not compelled. We can't be compelled to identify this, and, we choose not to follow this arbitrary law, of the railroads, this, arbitrary law of these highways, this arbitrary law of, agriculture. The federal government was already overreaching. It was getting really out of hand. See, the federal government was really contained under all the way up until Madison, and because our focus was this very hostile energy that was coming from Britain. I mean, we had to depose and finally get Britain to comply. And so once we no longer had those harassments, now the federal government could, not have to worry about looking over its shoulder. It started going down these paths, and it didn't take long under Monroe where they started deviating, and John Quincy Adams and then Jackson just went left.
Right.
Hard left. Anyway, or he went in a hard direction. It's not like he went communist, but that's my point. It was a slow, gradual process. And Jackson was the president in 1834. Or actually, No, I think it was Van Buren that came in at that point. Right? Because John Quincy Adams was elected in 26. He was reelected in 30. And so John Quincy Adams was now come, not Quincy Adams, but Martin Van Buren was replacing, was replacing Jackson, from one Democrat to the next. Go ahead.
All right.
So 41.
Thus, during the temporary nullification of the law, the results would be the same with those proceeding from an unqualified nullification. And the result of a convention might be that 7 out of the 24 states might make the temporary results permanent. It follows, and I think when he says 7, that would be like the 1/3, right? That would affect, keep something from being ratified, right? They only had, 7 out of the 24 states.
Well, yes. So right, because they would need 18 states to pass it, so the 7th state would actually be able to keep it from passing, correct?
Right, so that 7 out of the 24 states might make the temporary results permanent. It follows that any state which could obtain the concurrence of 6 others might abrogate any law of the U.S. whatever constructively and give to the Constitution any shape they please in opposition to the construction and will of the other 17, each of the 17 having an equal right and authority with each of the 7.
Okay,
every
so
feature the, in the Constitution might thus be successively changed.
Right, so, if you read about Republic Review, I talk about the power of the 13. There mm-hmm. is power of the 13 to keep things from becoming constitutional. Because if the Constitutional Convention forms, then if you have 13 states prior to, or you get 13 states to become steadfast on the principle that we must force compliance first and foremost before we consider any amendment. If you get states into that position, then bottom line, you end the dialogue of the convention completely. Hmm. Because what is the point of having a convention if you've got 13 states that say none shall pass? Whatever you try to throw at us is an amendment. We won't even consider it until we obtain full compliance. See, I'm giving the precise opposite view of the nullifiers in mm-hmm. demanding interposition using that 7th in this case or the 13th in our case today. Using the 13 states to actually, because, and I, if you're a legislator and you're listening to this, if you create a resolution that as a state, you will no longer debate the fact of a convention, you can actually do this. All you need is a majority to say we will no longer debate an Article 5 convention. We recognize what the federal government is doing is so far egregiously outside the framework of the Constitution and outside their authority that we demand compliance to the Constitution first.
Mm.
Done. The Convention of States, I mean, they have no traction ever again with a state legislator trying to have committees, no more time being wasted. So I know Teresa Manzella, a senator in Montana, is, you know, she's constantly being harangued over, you know, fighting back against this lunacy of a convention. But unfortunately, she's also, I mean, she's caught in this binary view that nullification. No, clearly, and I hope she listens to these three shows, because clearly Madison is saying that is an unconstitutional path. We can't allow that kind of chaos, because these other states, they will be, what do you want to call it? When you kind of get, you know, you become lackadaisical because, oh, well, we're not really suffering. We're not having mm-hmm. to suffer the loss. You're still paying for it in the taxes.
Right.
And the only way you don't pay for it in the taxes is if you secede from the union. Wow. And that's the worst thing. I mean, we need unity. We don't need division and separation. So When you really look at the two paths of nullification and our this, you know, this convention, interposition is the only way. I mean, it is very clear, but we'll pick up where we left off. I think we're in the mid of a paragraph. So, Paul, we'll have you on next week, hopefully, and we'll be able to move forward with Madison's notes on nullification. I'm hoping, folks, you're starting to see this, how interposition is the only way. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review, so please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.